Welcome, baseball fans, to episode 7 of the Banished to the Pen podcast, the audio component of the website Banished to the Pen, a group baseball blog produced by fans of the Effectively Wild podcast. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. This week, I am excited to be joined by two major contributors to Banished to the Pen, Scott Kushner and Nick Strangis. Nick and Scott, say hello, fellas.
Hello, Internet.
Very good. Did I get the names right, first and foremost?
Nailed it.
You actually got mine right. It's a breath of fresh air.
Wow. I would have definitely bet against getting that right, too. So that's a good start for the week. It means we're going to have a good show, guys. So first I want to start with, I'll go in alphabetical order, last name first. Scott, how about you just introduce yourself to the audience this week? Day job, Twitter handle if you're on Twitter, you know, team you root for, just, you know, a brief introduction, you know, sure, to the audience.
Sure. Well, my name is Scott Kushner. I am a college baseball coach at a small Division III school in New Jersey, Centenary College, not to be confused with another Centenary College that's in Louisiana. It happens all the time. I grew up in the Bay Area and I'm a Oakland A's fan from 3,000 miles away. And so it's very tough to keep on track of them. I'm usually asleep by the second inning if I even get them on TV at all. And otherwise, I've been coaching at the college level for, this is my 12th season doing it. And just really love being a part of the game and so close to it still after years of playing and watching.
How did you end up at your school? What was your kind of path to getting to be a head coach at Centenary?
Most coaching paths are pretty roundabout. I came to the East Coast for college. I went to Swarthmore College just outside of Philadelphia. From there, I went to graduate school for sports management up at UMass. Went back to my alma mater to start coaching and was an assistant for 3.5 years. And I got fortunate enough to actually get a head coaching job at the Merchant Marine Academy, which is one of the federal service academies. It's on Long Island. And that's it. Both Swarthmore and Merchant Marine Academy are both Division III schools. So I played Division III baseball at Swarthmore, coached it. And then from Merchant Marine Academy, after a couple years there, the job at Centenary opened up. And I was able to get that and moved out here. And also my wife ended up getting a job at the college as well after I got the coaching job. So both of us now work at this college.
Well, that's very cool. I'm looking forward to it. I've got a bunch of questions, obviously, for you, but we'll pause on that a little bit. Let's get Nick in here a little bit. Nick, same thing. Introduce yourself to the audience, Twitter handle, all that good stuff.
Sure. My name is Nick Strangis. My Twitter handle is @CapsOrphans. And I'm a network administrator by day. I actually have a bachelor's degree in theater arts and a master's degree in managing IT. So it's been a weird journey. But I actually root for the Chicago Cubs primarily. But I've lived in Atlanta for 12 years almost. And it's just been a fun team and, you know, irresistible not to latch onto them a little bit. So, you know, hopefully they will get things going in the right direction here.
How did you find your way to Atlanta?
I was a theater intern in 2003. I was working in IT as a day job and just applied for this. I applied for the internship first, got that. And I did that for a few years and it was a lot of fun. It's a good life. And some of my friends are still involved with acting and directing in different places throughout the country. So and I just every time I tried to get out, there was something else that sucked me back in again. So in spite of the fact that I've tried to move to Chicago, Seattle, and other places, it's I'm still here, and I'm still happy to be here.
Well, I guess you got an uptick in the weather, but probably a downtick in the traffic down in Atlanta. So
Yeah, totally. So I moved down here originally from Kentucky and went through South Carolina for college. So it's gotten warmer and warmer, and the traffic has gotten worse and worse. So
yeah, well, Nick will be also writing the Arizona Diamondbacks preview piece and the Braves preview piece, and that's Atlanta's the team that I really want to pick your brain on a little bit. But I'm going to first start with Scott. Once again, we're going to stay alphabetical if we can. A lot of questions I want to get to you about coaching at a D3 school and just what that's like. We haven't had a coach on, so I'm very curious to get your thoughts. First and foremost, at a D3 school, how do you go about recruiting your players?
Well, that's a main part of any coaching job is recruiting. For those who aren't familiar, Division III is not allowed to offer any kind of athletic scholarship. So there's not a single baseball player on my team or any athlete at this school that is given a dime by any of the sports programs that he or she is associated with. So I could find the best baseball player in the country, and he could want to come to my school, and I can't give him a penny toward his education. That doesn't mean he can't apply and get academic money from the school, but I just have no say over how much money he gets. And so now, fortunately or unfortunately, there's a lot of baseball players out there who just aren't capable of getting a Division I scholarship. Even Division I fully funded teams, the biggest teams in the country, your Florida State, Miami, USC, whatever, they only have, I think it's 11.7 scholarships at the Division I level. So if you're trying to fill a roster of 35 and you only have 11.7 scholarships, most of those guys aren't getting full rides either. So it's very tough to get a scholarship, and I think that's one of the big misnomers that coaches have to overcome, especially at the Division III level, is that so many kids, so many parents think that their kid is good enough to get a scholarship, and even the very best don't get full rides. So once you've kind of talked them down off that ledge that, hey, don't think that your kid is good enough to get, a $30,000 or $40,000 academic scholarship or athletic scholarship, and they start to see that, if they really do want to play baseball, Division III might be their only option. That's when you can start to really have the conversation of, this is what the school offers. If that seems like a good fit, then let's talk baseball, and then I can tell you about my program. And if that sounds good to you, then we might have a match.
Now, I have two follow-ups on that. First,
sure.
Is there a way that you can give a kind of a wink-wink, a nod-nod to the admissions people or, whoever the power that may be? Hey, I need this kid in here. I need a second baseman. Or, maybe we can't give him money for sports, but wow, look at that need that this child might need, or child, young man, I should say.
No, I mean, that's expressly forbidden by NCAA. Usually the only kind of nudge that we can give, and it really varies by school, is giving a little bit of leeway on the admission standards themselves. So if you're at a school and let's say your minimum GPA is a 2.5 and your minimum SAT on the math and the verbal is 1,000, and you have a kid that's a 2.3 and a 950, if they are a highly recruited athlete, that the coach might be able to, some schools call it a pick they have all kinds of terminology within the admissions department. And they can say, hey, can you give that kid a bump so that he can actually get into the school? But as far as the actual dollars and cents go, absolutely nothing, at least not if you're doing it legally. I don't like to throw shade on any other programs, but I'm sure there are some people who do get around it, but I'd like to think that it's usually on the up and up, and it's not permitted.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. The other question I wanted to ask you is just, I mean, I'm in the D.C. area today, and I think it's about 14 degrees. You're in New Jersey. What are the challenges, besides the weather, obviously, of, coaching at a northern D3 school, particularly this time of year?
I mean, it's very, very difficult. So we were talking off air a little bit about, we had practice today. It was 2 hours in a basketball gym. We've done that for the last 2 weeks, is be inside a basketball gym. It forces you as a coach to be very creative. I have a very large roster. This is the largest roster I've ever had. I have 42 players, which sounds like a lot because it is a lot. And half of those are pitchers. So I got 22 pitchers and 20 something position players. Some of the guys go both ways, and we get them all working in a basketball gym at the same time. So that's very difficult, not only to be productive in that space and with those restrictions, but also to keep them from going stir crazy and killing each other. It's brutal mentally as well as physically. We're supposed to play a doubleheader a week from today, and there's snow on the field, and we haven't been outside on a baseball field since October. Who knows if we're going to play, and that can really wear on you to get up for a game and then not be able to play it week after week.
Yeah, that kind of leads into another question off the script, but is one of your biggest challenges in recruiting finding the type of kid that one can accept that, his first game of the year is probably going to be the first time he's playing on actual dirt? And is it a certain grittiness is not the word, but it keeps coming back to me of, just the type of guy that's willing to put that type of work in and you know, at a D3 school, he's not getting a scholarship. I mean, is that maybe your biggest challenge?
Well, it depends on the school. So where I'm at now, we recruit very regionally. I'm in New Jersey. Most of our players are from New Jersey, from Pennsylvania, from New York, from Connecticut. So they're a little accustomed to playing in the cold. The college season starts sooner than the high school season, so it's a little colder than what they're used to, but they know what it's like to have indoor practice. They know what it's like to have some cold games. We just play a lot more of them. And it's, you know, instead of being 45 degrees, we might play in 35 degrees. So it's you already have a little bit of that makeup, but I can tell you at my previous institutions, at the Merchant Marine Academy, and also when I was a player at Swarthmore, I came from California. We might have been in a basketball gym one time in my life. I never wore long sleeves playing baseball. Then I went to the East Coast, and I was in for a very rude awakening trying to play games when I couldn't feel my hands to grip the bat or the ball. So I would say that I didn't have that grit, and I had to learn that grit as my college playing career happened. And I think that teams that recruit more nationally certainly have to look into that.
That's interesting. Nick, I know you had a couple of questions for Coach as well. I'd love to give you the floor here.
Oh, sure. I was wondering about dealing with parents because, you know, you're in college, but a lot of these kids, I'm certain, have parents that, you know, like you said, if they're regional, then they have parents close by. Do they give you trouble ever, or do you ever just have parents that reach out to you and say, hey, my kid's having a tough time. Can you, you know, sit down and talk to them and see what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, you do get a lot of I won't say a lot. I think that, it depends on the school. Like you said, you get a little bit more of it when it's regional, when the parents are close by. We get a lot of parents come to our games. Some even will come to our practice on occasion or just stop by campus to say hello. So you get a little bit of that. And I certainly want to have a cordial relationship with the parents. We're lucky that we have great parents with our team, and they gave us great support. However, especially when I was first starting out and I was a young coach, you know, I got my first head coaching job at, I think, 25. So I was really young and not much older than the players. And when I was that young and really starting out, and I didn't really know what I was doing, I was in a little over my head. You get parents who definitely think they can challenge you a little bit more and push you around, and they feel like they can dictate things a little bit. So I think once you get established as a coach and you've been doing it for a while and you have a good game plan and you have a good rapport with your players and with your parents, then you can kind of put your foot down a little bit and feel a little bit more comfortable making, you know, having a tough conversation with a player, really, and say, hey, listen, I'm dealing with you. I'm not dealing with your parent. You're an adult now. Make sure they understand that. And usually one conversation is all you need to do if that ever gets out of hand.
So, Scott, I was just wondering about how you use stats. Can you use stats at the Division III level and at your school? Or is there something else at play that trumps stats for you?
The short answer is yes, we absolutely do use stats. You know, the statistical significance of those stats might be up for debate. But, you know, really, if you look at the stats of our team or of teams that we play against or of any individual player, the cream does rise to the top pretty fast, I think. You know, the really, really good players are going to have stats that jump off the page that, I mean, you can quickly identify a guy that's a superstar. And maybe a little slower is to identify a guy who just can't hack it or a guy who maybe needs a little bit of time. But usually there'll be a pretty broad spectrum of stats there in terms of the guys that are really good and the guys that are really struggling. You know, you got to give some leeway for guys to, you know, get over slow starts. But, I mean, we play only a 40-game schedule, which is, you know, a quarter of a major league season. So, in the, you know, as far as sample size goes, yeah, it's not enough to really rely on it. But we kind of have to gamble a little bit. We have to go off of something. And in addition to the stats, I think what would trump stats for us is what we see on a day-to-day basis in practice. So, you know, I get to hit ground balls to my infielders time and time again. I may not know what their range factor is or what their, any defensive metric you want to use, but I know which guys I feel comfortable with fielding a ground ball, making a throw on a run, hitting a cutoff man, what outfielders can go and get a ball in the gap, and which guys they're probably going to play a single into a triple. Those sorts of things you can kind of glean from the day to day and the I'm with these guys 6 days a week and get to see them a lot. So you kind of pair the two things together, and usually the stats will back up what you're seeing with the naked eye. You know, call it a microcosm of baseball as a whole. I am both the stat department and the scouting department, and so are my assistants. My pitching coach is doing the same thing with the pitchers. Regardless of what a guy's ERA is or K to base on ball ratio or anything like that, he's seeing these guys throw bullpens every day, and he's able to determine which guys are the ones we want to rely upon when it's crunch time.
Well, and you guys have backgrounds, I'm guessing, from like you've gone to showcases, right? And you've seen a lot of players, in the area, probably all over the country by this point.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely do. But what's interesting is most coaches, I would say, have not gone through any kind of scout school. There's definitely a lot of subjectivity to it. I mean, there is even at the major league level where things are maybe a little more streamlined. But for us, every coach comes from a different background, sees things a little bit differently, likes things a little bit differently in their own style. So even if I've seen, I could be looking at the same 10 players as the coach sitting next to me, and I might like five of them and hate five, and he might have it reversed. But typically, and the guys that can really play jump out at you. And the guys that it's more about which projects are worth taking on and which projects are going to be a waste of time for the player and for the program.
I would like to ask another recruiting question if I can. I hate to circle back,
sure.
But the question that I have is, do you start recruiting before the kid and the guy sends in his application, or do you wait until the person applies and then start the recruiting process?
I would say the 95% of the time we are the impetus for the application itself. So a school like ours, like Centenary College, we have 1,300 full-time undergraduate students. We're located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, which most people in New Jersey don't know where that is. People who live 20 minutes away have never heard of the college. So most of the time, the only time they're even hearing about us is because I saw them at a baseball game or a showcase, or we saw their video on any number of recruiting websites, or we heard about them through a mutual friend, and we're reaching out to them and trying to get them interested in the school. And then what follows is, we'll bring them onto campus. They can maybe meet with the admissions, get a campus tour, meet some of the players, watch a practice, sit down with the coaching staff, and we can have a little bit of a powwow with the parents and the player, and they can ask questions and we can ask questions. So that's really what gets the ball rolling. And then it's okay, if you liked what you saw here, do the application, which can be done online. And then we can talk about doing an official visit, which would be like an overnight visit where they get to stay in the dorms and meet the players and that sort of thing. So it's a process. So the vast majority of the time we are, the tip of the spear as far as the recruitment goes. And then the school, obviously likes the fact that the coaches are out there pounding the pavement for them.
Well, I could ask you 100 questions, but I just have one more just for the sake of time. And
sure.
That's give me a projected win total for your team this year.
For my college team?
Absolutely.
Well, we have a 40-game schedule. The weather is making me wonder how many games we're actually going to get to play. But if we play 40, I have very high expectations for us. I'm really shooting for a 30-win season, which is kind of rarefied air. If you get 30 wins, you are one of the top teams in the region, if not in the country, and that's what we're shooting for this year.
Okay, 75 winning percentage. Maybe I'll call it that, to be fair.
That would be good.
All right, Nick, any more questions? Because, like I say, I know I could ask at least a dozen more.
I've got a million. I think I'm just going to have to make it up to New Jersey at some point and have a beer with Scott. So,
yeah, I would love to pick his brain.
Yeah.
So, okay, Nick, I'm calling you in from the bullpen. Here
Sounds
you go,
good.
Buddy. First of all, I know you as a Braves fan from, obviously your intro, but more from, your first few pieces on the site. As a Nationals guy, it's been kind of an interesting offseason to look at Atlanta and see what they've done. I have my own opinion. I would love to more give the floor to you and ask your thoughts on their offseason.
I think the feeling I get around here is there are a lot of fans that are a little surprised that you had Jason Hayward, you had Justin Upton, you had Freeman, you had Simmons, and so on, and that they weren't willing to give it a shot this season for 2015 and go out and try to win another year before maybe going into rebuilding mode, since you're going to lose probably Hayward, probably Justin Upton. But, you know, my, I guess my thoughts, my personal opinion is anytime you have regime change, even though most of the Braves front office is still around, and they even brought some guys back from who left when Frank Wren was there, it's new leadership. You know, John Hart and John Cappellella have a pretty awesome track record, so they're going to want to make their mark. And, you know, like I said before, I have like an MBA, so I have this like stupid, you know, business school voice in the back of my head that's saying it's about, you know, it's about branding, it's about creating the franchise that they want to create. And I just think they looked at the season and said, we don't have enough solid starting pitching innings coming back. They couldn't rely on Chris Medlin and Brandon Beachy coming back from Tommy John surgery for a second time to fill in those like 400 innings they lost. They had a poor farm system. Just digging in to try to write the Braves preview really revealed how many prospect writers thought this was a horrible farm system going into the offseason. And so once they reached that point where we could see they were rebuilding, and you know, initially they traded away Jason Hayward, brought back a major league asset in Shelby Miller, and then they signed Nick Markakis. So I was pretty anxious that they were equating Nick Markakis to Jason Hayward, which would be, you know, a huge warning sign. But once they started, you know, getting guys back for Evan Gattis, and I mean, if you bring back three, you know, two decent prospects and a third guy for Evan Gattis, that's a pretty good deal, I think. And, you know, they trade away Justin Upton, and maybe the return wasn't exactly what I'd hoped for, but the way that teams are kind of hugging prospects right now, you know, to see them rebuild their farm system in an off season and get off to a good start to the rebuild, I can deal with it. You know, just in terms of the baseball team and in terms of the franchise and not thinking about the stadium situation and everything else, I can hang in there with a team that says we're going to commit to being a great young team, and it's just going to take a couple years to get back to where we want to go. Because I believe in John Cappellella, and I think John Hart has an awesome track record, even though Texas, you know, when he was with the Rangers, it didn't exactly work out how they would have hoped, but he brought in a lot of great bats there. So maybe they can now work on bringing in those, you know, best in positions prospects, bringing in pitchers that aren't just kind of a hope and a dream, like Mike Foltynewicz, if I can say that correctly. You know, guys like that they brought in this offseason have been sort of like above average ceilings, and they need that kind of, you know, star player that like Addison Russell or Chris Bryant, like the Cubs have been bringing in. And so I have some hopes here, and I think there are some fun players that came into the system. There's a lot of speed. There's some good defenders. It could be an interesting, you know, ride. Now, as far as the major league team is concerned, I'm a little sad. I mean, Jason Hayward is one of my favorite players that's come along in the last few years. I was just blown away when they acquired Justin Upton. I've been a big fan of his for a long time. And to see those guys go is just kind of depressing. And fans down here bought into it. I mean, fans were stoked when it was going to be Upton and Upton and Hayward in the outfield. And I just think we feel like we don't know how we got to this point where, you know, we had Justin Upton, we had Jason Hayward. BJ Upton looked like he was going to be high risk, high reward. And now they've been out of the playoffs, you know, possibly for two straight seasons. I don't know how they got here, but I hope they're doing the right things to address it.
You brought so much up, and there's so many places I want to go. But the first place want to ask is kind of your point of view and the fan base's point of view of, I mean, up until July of last year, Atlanta was a really good team. I mean, you know, the Nats and the Braves were going kind of head-to-head. One team was up, one team was down.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden it kind of went in the tank, for lack of any better way to say it. But did you and the fan base want to see this rebuild happen, or were you all, hey, wait a minute, this team was really good until the last, you know, 6 weeks of the season?
I felt like they had to do something, and it may not have been completely throwing out, you know, getting rid of Hayward and trading Justin Upton, but they were going to need to make some big changes because you weren't going to get 200 innings of average pitching from Irvine Santana or Aaron Harang this year. And like I said, you had to deal with Chris Medlin coming back from Tommy John surgery and Brandon Beachy coming back. I would have liked to have seen some things go differently. I don't want to go into a whole mock off-season scenario. But yeah, if they really want to compete, here's the other thing. They keep saying that they're trying to stay competitive going into this season, even though they're redoing, you know, the minor league system, even though they're trying to build for the future. But I don't feel like the players that they're signing are the players that are going to get them closer to, say, 500 or being on the borderline of competing. I see them getting guys who are solid clubhouse guys like Johnny Gomes and Nick Markakis. And I think what the fans saw at the end of last year, the mood was that the team quit on Freddy Gonzalez. That was a big sort of speculation, big rumor. I think they finished like 4-14. And so, yeah, it's like we were competitive. If we had the guys last year, how come we can't get the guys for this year? I see a lot of that, and I hear a lot of that around Atlanta, that fans are just disappointed that, you know, maybe this wasn't exactly called for. Maybe there's something else that could have been done.
Yeah, I mean, 600 miles away in D.C., I would have rather seen – if I was a Braves fan, I would have rather seen them fire Gonzalez, get a new manager, and then try one more time, you know, with the same group, sign a couple of risky pitchers and see what you can do. If everything fails, then you sell off in July, Upton and Hayward, and how much worse off are you?
The big question is, what did you get for Justin Upton? You know, you got Max Fried, who could be a great pitcher, but he's going to miss all of this year, and a couple other guys. But couldn't you have maybe waited till July and then see if you get more? And I mean, I guess, yeah, there's an injury factor to consider. There's a risk factor, but he's been a great player. So how is it that we think that the return, you know, for a bunch of players that aren't going to make a big impact this year is more significant than what they could have got in July? Or Jason Hayward, you could say the same exact thing. And obviously with Shelby Miller coming back in the St. Louis, you know, in the trade with St. Louis, there's a different situation there. But like you said, maybe they could have held out. Maybe they could have done a few different things. You know, could you have maybe traded Jason Hayward, moved Justin Upton to right field, and looked for a good left field platoon, not Zoilo Amonte or Eric Young Jr. and Johnny Gomes, but really tried to push that envelope a little bit.
And now another name that I want to get from you too is the Markakis signing. You mentioned him. That signing seems to go counterintuitive to basically everything else they did this winter.
Absolutely. And I think so. Here's the rumor mill around Atlanta, and the speculation is Alex Wood actually said in an interview recently that he felt like at the end of the season last year, the guys were breaking off into cliques. And I don't mean to paraphrase him terribly, but that's the mood that maybe these guys didn't have strong leadership. Maybe they weren't able to pull it together, you know, as a team. And yeah, obviously we don't know what, you know, clubhouse chemistry, how much that matters at the end of the day. We can't really quantify it. But if, you know, if you're not unhappy showing up to work every day, of course your work is going to suffer, you know, possibly in short stints. So I can understand where they wanted a strong leader. They wanted a guy who could, you know, help buoy things. And I just don't get it from a value perspective. Markakis is maybe a 1.5 to 2 win player. And yeah, I, like you said, like, why are you giving him 4 years and like $40 million? He's, you know, moving into his like quote unquote post prime years, that like 32, you know, years of age and older years. So what's up with that? I can't figure it out at all, especially when you had guys like Nori Aoki out there. You could have signed him like a 1 year deal. I think he got like $5 million from the Giants. So, you know, and provide similar value. So, that kind of leaves me to believe that I guess what they're looking for are guys that fans recognize and guys that they know won't cause trouble. So they're really just holding maybe the status quo for this year, for next year, and trying to, you know, while they rebuild things for 2017.
Well, that makes sense. Let me do a Zach Morris timeout here. Coach,
yeah, sure.
Your thoughts on the value of clubhouse chemistry? I mean, I think you'd be a great person to ask. What are your thoughts on the value of it? Is it overblown, underblown? Just thoughts.
I'm sorry, that was to me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that I've coached teams and been on teams that got along very, very well, and teams that absolutely the players hated each other or hated the coaches or both. If you have talent, you can always win. You can win, and you may not like the guy playing next to you or the guy sitting alongside you in the dugout, but if you really have superior talent, you're not going to stop playing because you're not buddy-buddy with your teammates. That said, I think you can reach a slightly higher level with having a close relationship there. So it's, you know, it's squeezing that every last drop out of the talent that you can get. I think chemistry can go a long way for it. I would also say, though, that chemistry can sometimes backfire. If you got guys that are really tight off the field, that might mean that they want to party a little bit more together, or they, you know, they get distracted a little bit more as well. With, you know, at my level, it's with girls, or it could be skipping class or going out to a party the night before. So that's something you got to be careful for. At the major league level, where their temptations are even greater, I can only imagine if you got a little click, that could be bad for those guys.
That's a really interesting take. Once again, I could ask a dozen questions on that, but I got to go back to my man Nick here. And Nick, I want to tag you back in, and I want to ask about Atlanta's the situation with their stadium. It's once again, I have the perspective from a DC guy, but your thoughts and kind of the fan base's thoughts on, you know, the new stadium and, you know, the movement, you know, to, I guess it's Gwinnett?
It's actually Cobb County. So we've got two big giant counties that sit on the northeast and northwest side of Atlanta. Gwinnett's to the northeast up I-85, and Cobb is up I-75 to the northwest. And what they found was a pocket in Cobb County that is technically speaking a city, an Atlanta address. But it's in Cobb County. I don't know how the politics come to play there, but it is technically. So in Atlanta, we have outside the perimeter, and the perimeter is 285, makes a circle around the city. And then we have inside the perimeter. So I live inside the perimeter. And of course, we're all big snobs. And we think that outside the perimeter, you just have a bunch of like yahoos and whatever. And they look down inside the perimeter from outside, and they go, oh, there's a bunch of crime and a bunch of criminals and a bunch of hippies. So this brings up a lot more than just, you know, having to travel to the northwest or travel back and forth. There's, you know, some, I think, cultural issues at play going on, you know, in terms of hard feelings from people in the city that they're taking away our team, and that it's not going to be the Braves anymore. It's going to be the Cobb County Braves. And that changes who the team is culturally as far as the people who are there day in and day out. But I think that really it's not a huge dividing issue. That's just sort of, you know, the overview. And people are seem to be generally sad that the Braves are leaving this spot that they've had ever since they came down here from Milwaukee. And I know people who live north of the city, so not far from where the stadium is going to be, and they really don't see a big advantage to the new stadium, because at the end of the day, it all comes down to traffic. And if you have a hard time getting in your car after work and driving 30 to 45 minutes to get to where the stadium is now, it probably won't get a lot better. I don't want to go into the entire geography of Atlanta, but where the stadium is going is at the cross section of I-75 and I-285, which is crazy at 5:30, 6 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, you know, Thursday evening. It's almost as bad as it is anywhere else in the city. So because they have not put in any sort of extra public transit there, so there's not going to be a new train. So to compare this to, say, you know, Wrigleyville or even Target Field, where you have some sort of public transportation where you can just get on it, you get off right at the door, and you're right there. Or even Navy Pier, right? Because in Washington, if I'm not wrong, you get off a subway stop and you're like right there. Isn't that the case?
You got it. About a block and a half. Yeah.
It's one of the nice parts. Like the Navy Pier too. So.
Yeah, that's actually one of the very few benefits of Nationals Park. But something that jumped out to me that you were talking about, once again, I have the outsider's point of view, but you said that, first of all, leaving the stadium was kind of sad for a lot of the fans. First of all, that stadium stinks. There's nothing great about that stadium, unless I'm – I mean, I was there once.
I think outsiders like it less than insiders.
Okay.
They have a few – so, yeah, the stadium actually is nothing special to look at. I mean, it's just sort of this, you know, round outfield. There's no distinguishing characteristics, I guess I would say, about the field itself. I don't know. Have you been to a game in Atlanta before, Ryan?
I have, but it was – it was before I really became a diehard baseball fan. So, I mean, it was 10, 12 years ago. It was a while ago.
Yeah. I've always had a good experience with customer service there. They've added some cool food options because Atlanta has become like a big foodie city, a good destination in the Southeast. So there's a place in Atlanta where they have some of the best cheeseburgers in the Southeast, and they now serve those cheeseburgers at the stadium. So it's Holman and Finch Burger. They have a, I guess people up north don't care about Waffle House, but they have a Waffle House in the stadium, which is kind of a funny, like quirky Southern thing. You know, and some other things here and there that I've come to appreciate.
Well, they need to get,
I just can't complain. Maybe it's less of, I think it's a great destination, more of it. I can't complain. I've always had a good time, you know, going to games there. So,
well, they need to put a cheetah club in there if they want to start filling some seats. Other criticism is you said that, you know, the fan base was upset. My criticism has always been you guys haven't sold out some playoff games of yours. So,
right. I think it's the traffic. I mean, this has come up, I think, in, when any coverage has happened about the stadium move ahead of the negotiations that broke down very quickly, the city of Atlanta, obviously, the issue that was brought up over and over again was that the Braves weren't very happy about the traffic situation, wanted some kind of, you know, relief. And I don't know what anybody could do about it. I mean, there's no train that goes there. It probably don't have the money to build a train to go right to Turner Field. If you built more interstate lanes, you would just get more traffic, you know, over time. You know, to get back to that point, like, I almost can't blame people for not going, but yeah, it's a little sad. I mean, I am a little bit upset with Braves fans for not showing up. You know, I went to the first game of the Dodgers Braves series where Clayton Kershaw is pitching, and you could have sat anywhere for $10 probably if you'd waited and gone on StubHub. My friend picked up, he started with seats for $20 in the upper deck, and the day of the game, we traded those $20 seats for $20 seats in dead center field, you know, maybe six rows back, getting that nice center field shot that you see on TV behind the pitcher.
Jeez.
So, it's been rough. And to be honest, I don't know, after the shine wears off of the new stadium, I would be surprised if it doesn't happen again. Especially considering Atlanta, people are moving into the city of Atlanta, not out of the city of Atlanta. So, you know, I'd like to see some proof that it's going to get better.
Well, that statement there leads to, once again, I could go into another 10 questions, but
yeah, that's fine.
We'll leave the stadium alone for now. And last question, 2015 win total.
I'm going to go with 73, one win less than Pecota sees them winning. I don't see a very good team. And if they start trading off guys, and I hope they do, if they're not winning, you know, in July, for God's sakes, just go ahead and trade people. Don't do what the Twins have done in the past, or what, you know, some other teams have done, and just wait forever. Get the value now when it's out there. So I'm going to go with 73 wins.
Sounds good. All right, let's plunge ahead, guys. I want to throw out a topic kind of and let you guys more or less just take the floor. Kind of the biggest topic in baseball right now is speeding up the game, particularly at the major league level. I think we've started a few times with Scott, so let's start with Nick this time. Nick, just your general thoughts on the speed of the game. You think it needs to speed up? Like I said, just give you the floor. What do you think?
In theory, I don't have a problem with the length or pace of games. That being said, there is a ton of time that we're watching baseball, and they're not playing baseball. They're standing on the mound, or the guy is standing outside of the box, and that all adds up, you know, in terms of my attention span And before the, you know, earlier in this conversation, Scott mentioned trying to watch an A's game and not being able to stay awake past the second inning. And yeah, I noticed if I try to watch the Mariners match up with the A's, and that can be a pretty big matchup these days, and I want to get past the third or fourth inning, you know, if you could cut 20 minutes off the game, I might be able to convince myself to stay up a little later and just tough it out. But knowing that those games are going to run from, you know, 10 o'clock my time until the early hours of the morning, you know, right now I'm probably turning off the game at a certain point when I feel comfortable that I've seen what I want to see. So there is an impact to me. There is a difference in cutting off those, you know, however much time you can cut off. The question is, to me, can they get everything done at once? Because if you just take, you know, 10 seconds off of a pitch, you know, if you take 10 seconds off the clock between pitches, or if you, you know, get the batter to stand in there and not step out of the box, one of these things alone isn't going to do it. So what I hope to see from Major League Baseball is if they're going to work on pace of play, they're going to focus on, you know, the actual pace of play, which means the time between events in the game, and that they're going to take like an all of the above approach, and they're just going to push to do everything they can, because you're not going to see a big difference if it's just one rule or a second rule. I guess that's just my personal opinion.
Coach, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree. I think pace of play is almost more important than length of game. When the pace of play is slow, it makes even short games feel long and dreadful. That's something that we really try and instill. I mean, it's usually dictated by the pitchers. And I'm sure somebody's done this probably on our side, if not Baseball Prospectus, and just looked at maybe what pitchers take a long time. I know obviously the Red Sox and the Yankees get a rep for it, but it's probably has to do with who's on the mound more than anything. And it just, I mean, I'm as engrossed in the games as anybody can be, particularly the games that I'm coaching. And when my pitcher's taking a long time on the mound, I can't keep my attention on the game. It is just murder. So I can only imagine what a fan in the stands is doing, or what you're doing over 162 games. If you're a player, if you're a coach, or if you're a fan who goes to a lot of games or watches a lot of games on TV, it's brutal. And that's, you know, we're actually fortunate, I guess, we're the guinea pigs. NCAA is. We've been using the pitch clock for I think 4 years now in our games. So I know that's something that is coming down the road pretty soon for Major League Baseball. But, you know, and I was strongly opposed to it when it first came on, you know, with all the same kind of John Lester type, oh, there's no clock and all that kind of stuff. I'll be honest, I don't even notice it. Don't even notice it. And if I do notice it, it's for the better, because it doesn't come into play. Like, you're not getting a lot of automatic ball or automatic strike calls, but you are a little conscious of it, and it just gets people on and off the field a little faster. Gets the pitcher down to business a little bit faster. Gets the guy in the box a little faster. So, you know, I got to think that will be a small step in the right direction for pace of play.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm in a minor league park probably 50 or 60 nights a year. I'm at a college game probably 20 times a year. The speed and the pace of those games, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you know, obviously everybody can have a bad day pitching on the mound, and then that lengthens an inning. But for the most part, I have no problem with the length of those games. It's, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes, and, you know, you're in and out, and it's no problem. But the biggest thing you notice is the time between innings to me. It's absolutely, it drags at the major league level, whereas at the college and the minor league level where the TV isn't involved and you don't have the talking heads between innings, that's where the speed really comes into me. So that's probably the biggest thing that I notice. So
sure. The challenge would be then to just, how do you monetize, you know, if you're going to shave 30 seconds off of a commercial break, like, find other ways to monetize it, I think, short of turning player uniforms into NASCAR.
I wondered if baseball could, I don't know, like, have they looked into the way European soccer matches, or you just have sponsors? I mean, obviously, like you said, like, their whole stadium is monetized. You know, everything you see in a whatever, a football stadium in Europe is monetized, but and their uniforms are as well, like, you know, just like you were talking about. But could you add advertising that's just there, you know, during the game, throughout the broadcast, I don't know. You know, there've got to be some ideas out there about you could clamp down on, you know, straight up ads maybe and focus on other ways.
And to build off that point, if now you have three commercials of 30 seconds rather than four between innings, you know, can you charge 25% more for those commercials because there's limited time now? And like right. you said, could they put an advertisement in the top right corner of the television like they do during the World Cup, and there's your ad for 45 minutes?
Sure. And honestly, baseball's even done some of this. I mean, if you watch a game now, you usually have rotating ads on the backstop that you're watching the game.
Oh, that's right.
That didn't exist that long, you know, a few years ago. I mean, they're finding ways to monetize more and more while the game is being played, and yet we're still getting the long commercial break. So baseball is getting at both ends now, and maybe, like you said, can they charge a higher premium because, you know, there's just not as much airtime to fill? Perhaps, but I'm sure at this point the owners are probably trying to get every dime they can, and, you know, you can understand that impetus.
Well, let me ask you guys another question then, kind of on this topic, is if they gave you the power, you're the commissioner all of a sudden, Rob Manfred decides that you guys have 24 hours, what would you implement? What would be your move to try to speed up the game if there's anything that you would do? I think we started with Scott a couple times. Nick, how about we start with you, bud?
Sure, to put me on the spot.
Of course.
I'm more than happy to see, you know, look, we had rules in high school, in Babe Ruth, basically where the batter is not supposed to step out, you know, of the box between pitches. Now, that was more met with the umpire yelling at you if you were taking too much time. But, you know, at the major league level, sure, like when you bring in the pitch clock, make sure the batter is not stepping out of the box and holding up the game. I just, like you said, like I said before, I'm for the all of the above approach. So if we're going to do it, let's have the pitch clock. Let's have the between the innings clock. Let's have the clock that monitors when the pitchers are going to change. You know, when you have a pitching change in the game, let's keep them to a limit of how much time they're going to take to get in. Obviously, you would want to make exceptions for injuries, and that could lead to some exploitation of, ow, my arm hurts, you know, I need to see the coach or the trainer. But I think for the most part, people would be adults about it. There would be a transitional period, and then teams would, you know, just move ahead with it. And so I would tell Manfred, you know, let's do it all. Let's just go for it. And so let's get the pitch clock. Let's get the, you know, the change clock. Let's get the pitcher change clock. And let's limit what the batter can do to slow down the game. I'm not in favor. I'll just say briefly, I'm not in favor of anything that changes actually how the game is played. So I really don't like the no intentional walk pitching rule. I don't like any rules that would be about pickoff attempts. Those kind of rules I'm not a fan of. So as much as we can, let's try to stay away from rules that impact how the game is played, and let's just focus on what happens between innings, between pitchers, things of that nature.
Right. Coach, what would you do?
Well, I'm of the same mind as Nick. I think a lot of the things he said there were right on point. I'll add one, and I'll kind of tag on a little bit to what he was saying. As far as the whole injury thing and removing pitchers, I think one way you can get around it, and I can't take credit for this idea, I'm sure I read it actually, I think on our website, is anybody who's removed from an inning due to injury has to be placed on the DL. So that kind of gets away from gaming the system a little bit. You know, you're going to say your arm's hurt so you don't have to face the lefty. Well, you're spending 2 weeks on the DL, and I think that would curb that kind of behavior pretty quick. The other thing I think that could be broken down a lot is catcher calling time and going out to chat with the pitcher. That is especially, like, I mean, you think of some of the catchers that are out there now. They're basically a coach on the field. And, you know, you think of like a guy like Yachty gets this reputation of being, you know, a pitcher whisperer. And he gets to call time as many times as he wants and jog out there and have a little meeting on the mound. And that just, and it completely, you know, takes the wind out of the sails of the game. And you're just sitting there waiting for these two guys to have a conversation, and then they go back and, you know, they've got to run through their signs again, and then there's a runner on second. They need to make sure everything's kosher again, so he'll call time and go out there. And I don't know how often that gets played up, and maybe it changes from team to team or from catcher to catcher. But those are the kind of things where, again, it doesn't change the actual play of the game, but it's something that is exploited, particularly by the catchers who are, you know, more veteran and are leaned on a little heavier. You know, I think you can definitely put either a limit on that, a cap on that, or eliminate it altogether. You want to go meet at the mound? Great. It's a meeting on the mound. Bring your pitching coach.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. You got a couple other ones. I want 1 foot in the batter's box. You got to keep 1 foot in. So none of this Neil Walker doing a full circle around and looking up at the sky and all this stuff. I mean, right off the bat, keep a foot in the batter's box. There's no reason you can't look at your sign from your third base coach and still keep your foot in there. Second, I want 5 warm-up pitches. Get rid of this 8 or 9 nonsense. Get in there. We're going to cut 30 seconds off, you know, between innings. Right there, there's 9 minutes of dead time for the game right there that we just saved. And the final thing, if the game is supposed to start at 7 o'clock, let's start the game at 7. Let's not do this where they go, you got to talk to the announcers, they've got to rehash everything that was said at the pregame show the half hour before. Let's just get going. First pitch, hey, all right, we got these guys on the mound. Let's roll. I mean, that's just dead time like we all say. We're trying to go to bed at a decent hour. That's just killing time. So
that makes sense. And, you know, I wonder how many players would be happy to get out of the park a little bit earlier. You know, let's say they're in, you know, you have an Atlanta Brave and he's from down here and he's got 6 games that he's going to be in Atlanta. Like, wouldn't he be happy to see his family or at least somebody, you know, for a few more minutes each day out of those, you know, 6 games? I just wonder if that's, you know, another thing too, like you can sell it to him that way. So we'll see.
Well, I know that John Lester, one of the big selling points that they tried to give him with the Cubs was, you know, the fact that he could be home for dinner with his family a lot. So I think there's something to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So guys, we could talk about this subject, I know, for another hour, but we got to kind of cut it here for time. Final question I throw out every week. It's a little lighthearted, but what is your biggest baseball pet peeve? And I'm going to start with Coach this time since we started with Nick, I believe, last time. Coach, biggest pet peeve?
I was thinking of a way to put this. I guess my biggest thing is I don't like the dismissiveness of experts. So, and I'll try and give you a couple examples so I can explain what I mean. So you have like kind of the stats side of things and the scouting side of things. And I know that those two factions are merging a little bit more cleanly now. But, you know, you even have it within coaching ranks of how hitters should hit rotational versus linear or the mechanics of a pitcher and which is higher probability of injury. But I think, like, the main thing is that what's true now or what's true at a particular level is not necessarily true for everybody. So I use bunting as a pretty big example here. You know, I think when Sabermetrics really got going, bunting was kind of seen as, you know, this is really a bad strategy. To sacrifice an out for 90 feet, you're really doing yourself a disservice. But I believe me, I'm not a big advocate of the sacrifice bunt. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I think that you have to look at each individual, you know, pitcher batter matchup, who's on deck, what are they going to do, what's the base runner like. And I think there's a lot of different factors you have to take into account there. And so bunting as a strategy shouldn't be dismissed wholeheartedly. And I know there's a lot of people, some very sabermetrically minded people, who think it's stupid any time a guy squares around to drop a bunt down. And I don't think that's a good way to go about it. It's not black or white. There's a lot of gray area there. And I think a great irony of sabermetrics is that because there's been this kind of push to curb bunting or really reduce it, sabermetrics has also resulted in a lot of defensive shifts, which I'm a big fan of. And now what's the counterpunch to a defensive shift? Dropping down a bunt. So you've eliminated this one skill or pushed to eliminate this one skill, and now through kind of a roundabout process, that one skill might actually be a very important skill to counteract a different strategy. So there's a lot of gray area out there. Be careful about standing on pedestals and saying my way is right and it's always right.
Well, and even to further your point, you know, teams were scoring 4.5 runs a game 10 years ago. Now they're scoring 3.5. So the value of a run is not the same. It's not an apples to apples comparison to where we were. And scoring in the college game and bunting at that level where you're at is a much different game than, you know, maybe even at
when we don't bunt to sacrifice. We bunt to create chaos. I think there's a much greater opportunity for a ball to be mishandled, thrown away, you know, any number of terrible things for the defense that can really lift an offense. So, You know, I don't look at it as I'm going to give you an out so I can get 90 feet. I look at it as I'm going to put some pressure on you and you'll probably mess up.
Probably particularly early in the season.
Is a huge part of it, yep.
Okay, so that's a good one. Nick, biggest pet peeve?
I have so many. I really liked what Scott said, but I'm just going to go with baseball writers and broadcasters who just say things that are just so off the wall, so unfounded, so untrue at times. I don't know why it is that I can know a handful of people who seem to know more about the game or what's going on in the game or basic stats that, you know, a player have than the people who are being paid to cover baseball, you know, at least for the 4 or 5 months out of the year when it's running. That's my biggest pet peeve, you know, to tune into a broadcast and just hear guys say things. I guess this goes back to like Fire Joe Morgan, where they would, you know, fact check things that Joe Morgan used to say. I just don't get it. You know, I shouldn't turn on the TV and feel like I know more than somebody on the screen. And maybe that's just me being arrogant sometimes. But I love hearing great color analysts who can fill in and tell me, behind the scenes, like why a player, is shading a certain direction or why a pitcher is pitching a certain way. But I wish guys would leave, you know, the analysis to the guys who know the stats analysis. And I wish they would, just take a few minutes to ask themselves, you know, what can they improve on and work on those things. So that's all I've got.
And even to your point, one of my favorite things, and when you're watching a broadcast and most of the color guys are former players, I love getting that perspective. Okay, what were you thinking in this situation when you would come up to pinch hit? Or what were you looking for in this scenario? Or what would you be looking for here? I think just to kind of build off your point, I think that's something that, you know, I'd like to hear more of. So.
Totally. I do like, you know, there are some guys like Steve Stone who for years, even when he was with the Cubs, he can see something coming and he can tell you what's coming. And a lot of times, whatever it is he says is about to happen, at least, you know, my perspective was that, you know, good chance that's going to happen next. You know, they're going to try to get a guy to roll over on an off-speed pitch or whatever it is. But, you know, that I want to hear more of that and less just off-the-wall speculation. You know, like when you're writing, we're all trying to be writers or pretend to be baseball writers. And what a lot of feedback I get from editors is to be sure that, you know, get the facts straight on this opinion or that opinion, that there's a source for it. So, you know, if we're trying really hard to make sure that we're doing things accurately and we're just amateurs, I would like to see some effort on the part of professionals to make sure they've got their facts straight before they start leading the viewers astray or the listeners astray.
I like that one. I can dig it. Very cool. So, all right, guys, that's wrapping up. We've done a real good hour of baseball talk here. I want to kind of cut it off here. Maybe this is a good spot. Once again, I want both Nick and Scott to let's have you just Twitter handle where they can find your work, where they can find you, and all that good stuff. Let's start with Nick. We'll go alphabetical in the first name.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at CapsOrphans. You can find me writing for banishedtothepen.com. It's the only blog I contribute to.
That's very cool. Nick's doing some great work. And like I said, he's going to be doing an Atlanta Braves preview, I believe, and definitely the Arizona preview. So look for that in the coming weeks. Scott, you know, your final goodbye.
I actually have two Twitter handles. One is my own personal account. That's SL_Kush, KUSH. And that's, you know, baseball and other non-baseball related tweets. And then if you want to follow my team, it's at CCBaseball. And that, you know, it'll be just updates on our team. And sometimes it'll be links to articles about the games and anything like that. I know a few members of Effectively Wild and Banished to the Pen have reached out to me. So if you want to follow us along there, you can do that. Or you can just look at our website, which is centenarycyclones.com, and that you can look at stats and roster and all that kind of stuff too. And of course, I'm also contributing to Banish to the Pen, which I am so proud to be a part of. It's really an awesome environment and group of people that have put this together. I feel very fortunate to just be a part of it, and to contribute to this podcast has been awesome.
Well, your contributions have been great, and I think it's fair to say I can speak for the whole site that you're now our favorite D3 baseball team and favorite coach. So that's for sure.
Can I buy a hat? Do you have a tech store?
We definitely have some hats.
Awesome.
Very nice.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Well, I want to thank you both, one, for all your contributions to the site. You guys have both been doing great work. And two, I want to thank you guys for joining me today. This is, like I said, a great hour of baseball talk. And I definitely love the perspectives both from you guys. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Yeah, you're doing a great job. I really appreciate everything you're doing.
That's very nice of you guys. I look forward to having you guys on again in the future.
All right. Take care.
Till next time.
And that was episode 7 of Banished to the Pen with contributors Scott Kushner and Nick Stranges. Thanks to them for joining me today and for their hard work thus far on the site. They've been doing some great stuff. Also, I'd like to thank all the writers, editors, contributors, and the technical staff at the site as well. We have a lot of people working very hard to put out a very good product, and a lot of people are doing very hard work and not getting a lot of appreciation sometimes. So I want to give you guys a big shout out and well, pat on the back, Barry Horowitz style, for the good work you guys are doing. So with that, we are finished. This is your host, Ryan Sullivan, at natsgm.com on Twitter, reminding you, be nice to your fellow listeners.